already.
Sam Hopkins. You have known Johns Hopkins all your life. Tell me why you're so interested in Johns Hopkins.
Well, the first thing is that all of our family loved Johns Hopkins. He was very good to his relatives. Johns Hopkins was good to his parents. His mother lived with him most of her life, and one of his sisters, who was a widow, lived with him and kept house for him. But I was descended from Samuel Hopkins, was one of his nephews. And when he died, he left all of his nephews and nieces about $100,000 each. So everybody in the family loved him and admired him, and he was good to them, and I think they all very much appreciated it. So he was sort of a role model for all of us, and we were sort of brought up to try to be somewhat like Johns Hopkins and try to do what he did to be helpful to the community.
As you were growing up, did you know anyone who had actually known Johns Hopkins?
Well, I'm sure I did, but I wasn't too conscious of it. I'm sure my grandmother, who I knew, Grandmother Hopkins, knew him, but she died when I was 3 or 4 years old. But there were others who knew him, but they all in the family liked him, but there were a lot of people in the community who didn't like Johns Hopkins. They were sort of different from the rest of the people. They were very anti-slavery. But sort of put him out of step with the rest of the people. They were very businesslike. And one of the reasons for their success was that the people in other states trusted them, and for that reason they were able to do a lot of business with people outside of Maryland. And that was one reason Baltimore was successful. These people were artisans, and they were successful. Now, another thing is that some of Johns Hopkins' family, when they freed their slaves, and they did it early on in the late 1700s, they moved from farming to business, and this was true of Johns Hopkins' mother's, grandmother's brother, Evan Thomas, who freed his slaves in the 1780s and with 5 children moved to Baltimore. And one of his children married Elias Ellicott. Another one married the son of Elisha Tyson, who was probably the leading abolitionist in the United States at the time. And his sister, Johns Hopkins' Aunt Margaret Hopkins, married Elisha Tyson's brother, Jesse Tyson, whose son founded the Mutual Chemical Company, which became the largest chrome refinery in the world. So when Johns Hopkins came to Baltimore, he was well surrounded with relatives who were well established and had been successful. Now, Evan Thomas's wife was Johns Hopkins' aunt, great aunt, and their son, Philip Thomas and Evan Thomas, were founders of the B&O Railroad. Evan Thomas went to England and saw the railroad over there, and he came back and got people interested here in founding the B&O Railroad, of which his brother, Philip Thomas, who was Johns Hopkins' father's double first cousin, became the first president, and later Johns Hopkins became a director of and sponsored John W. Garrett, who became the very successful president of the B&O Railroad. Another thing is that when Johns Hopkins came to Baltimore, among his family were founders of the Anti-Slavery Society in 1789. They included Jesse Tyson, who had married his Aunt Margaret Hopkins. They included his uncle Gerard Hopkins, who he came to Baltimore to work for. They included Elias Ellicott, who had married his father's double first cousin. They included James Carey, who married Martha Ellicott, and whose grandson became the first president of the Board of Trustees of the Johns Hopkins Hospital and was largely responsible for bringing people there who were successful and made the institution what it is today. In fact, one of the characteristics of Johns Hopkins in his business career in picking trustees was he was a very good judge of people. He seemed to have a knack for people, for picking people who would do a good job, and his greatest contribution, in addition to giving money to the hospital and the university was choosing an able group of trustees who in turn interested able people in coming to the university and hospital and founding the institute, carrying on these institutions. And he really established two institutions which provided great opportunities for other people to participate and who in over the years have contributed not only their personal talents but immense amounts of money to make the institution what it, they've been since his death.
How did Johns Hopkins know the various people who were the first trustees?
Well, a good many of the trustees were relatives. I mean, one of them was Lewis Hopkins, who was his nephew, and another was Thomas Morris Smith, whose niece's portrait is up here to my left, who married my grandfather, Samuel Hopkins, Martha Ellicott Tyson Smith. And but these were, and the others were very good. They were dedicated people, and at the time the university and the hospital was founded, they went all over the went to Europe and saw how things were done there, and they tried to find model institutions which would be pioneers in advancing education in the United States. But I'd like to go back to the background of Johns Hopkins.
Please do.
But Johns Hopkins' family came to Maryland. They were attracted here by Maryland's policy of religious toleration, which was a time in Europe where religious toleration was not the pattern. And in 1649, Virginia banished Puritans from Virginia, and about 300 of them came to Maryland and founded Anne Arundel County, which is where Johns Hopkins' family grew up in 1660. The Quakers were banished from Virginia and came to Baltimore and settled in the Patapsco Valley region. So this was the environment. Then in 1654, a Quaker missionary named Elizabeth Harris came to Maryland, and she was very well received here, and people were attracted by her policy of human equality. This was a time when society was very stratified and human equality just wasn't recognized. That she taught people that they should respect other people and they should accept responsibility for helping people in need. So this created an environment. Now the other thing is that next, in 1782, Johns Hopkins' mother's family, Thomas Janney, came to Pennsylvania with William Penn. He was attracted to Pennsylvania. He had become a member of the Society of Friends in England by Penn's policy, not only of religious toleration, but of religious freedom. They had complete freedom of religion in Pennsylvania, which was an innovation. So I think that now other families that came were associated with Tyson when he came, with Hopkins when he came to Baltimore, were the Tysons. Elisha Tyson and Jesse Tyson's ancestor, Rhonda Tyson, came to Pennsylvania in 1682 from Krefeld, Germany, where they'd been banished by the authorities there. They were Mennonites, and they came and one of the things that this little group of 13 Mennonite families did was they adopted the first remonstrance against slavery in 1688, which is known as the Germantown Remonstrance. And since then, they carried on this tradition, the family of being opposed to slavery. And Johns Hopkins' grandfather, Johns Hopkins, freed his slaves in about the 1780s, as did his great uncle and his wife, who was Johns Hopkins' great aunt, freed their slaves, and that's when the Thomas family moved to Baltimore and engaged in trade. But another thing that Philip Thomas did, who became the first president of the B&O Railroad, when the Washington Monument was founded, he was one of the first major contributors to get the thing started. He contributed $25,000. So, but then Johns Hopkins, when he came to Baltimore to live with his uncle, Jared Hopkins, Jared owned a place which is now called Hopkins Place. That's why we have Hopkins Place in Baltimore. And he had his business at roughly Lytton Pratt Street, as also was where Elias Ellicott had a wharf. So you had this group of people that were very close. Another thing that Jared Hopkins was interested in, and Elias Tyson, they were very instrumental in getting Benjamin Banneker's almanacs published, the first one, I think, 1792. So they were basically, they were in many ways were people who were ahead of their times. And I think that so as a result of this, Baltimore in the 19th century became Maryland's leading center of philanthropy. You had George Peabody, you had Johns Hopkins, you had Enoch Pratt as good examples, and Moses Shepard. Now Moses Shepard was the first cousin of Jesse Tyson and Elisha Tyson. His original Shepard ancestor, the shoemaker, came over here from Germany in 1688 and settled in Germantown, Pennsylvania. So they were a fascinating group of people, and I think that they all had a strong desire to do what they could to enrich the lives of other people in the community.
I've always been curious whether they were close friends.
What was that?
Whether Peabody and Pratt and Shepard were good friends, and did they work in concert, and did they, because they seem to have covered so many different bases of need in this city.
Well, I think John W. Garrett was a very close friend of George Peabody, and John W. Garrett invited Johns Hopkins to have dinner with George Peabody, and at that George Peabody told Johns Hopkins about how much pleasure he had gotten out of his philanthropy. And following that, Johns Hopkins drafted a will in which he established it, the Johns Hopkins University. This was done in 1867, and picked trustees for the university and the medical school, which well preceded his death. I think it was 1873. So Johns Hopkins and Peabody were close, as is an article by a man who wrote Peabody's life, which details this relationship very closely. Moses Shepard, I don't think, probably knew George Peabody as well, but I'm sure he did. But as you know, Moses Shepard founded what's now known as the Shepard Pratt Hospital, in which he was joined by Enoch Pratt. Moses Shepard left $567,000 to found the hospital, and then Leland Pratt, when he died, left about $1,500,000. But the common characteristics of all these people was they took care of their family, they were strongly interested in their family, and after they'd taken care of their family, it was then that they made their contributions to charity and society. And I think that Johns Hopkins and these people give examples which I think it'd be good for more people to know about, and with the hope that you'd have more people who've been successful in business or the arts or otherwise take an interest in philanthropy and helping to solve the problems of the world.
How did Johns Hopkins focus in on the idea of a university and a hospital?
Well, I don't know. Johns Hopkins, of course, had to leave school at the age of 12, and he was very much interested in other people having education. He was also interested in health. During his lifetime, Hopkins was one of the managers of the mental institution, which was in Maryland, which was one of the first established, and Enoch Pratt also became a manager of the same institution. Another thing, in 1844, the Maryland Historical Society was founded, and a couple of years later, they raised $35,000 to build a building, and Johns Hopkins became the chairman of the building committee in the 1850s when the first YMCA building was built in the United States. John W. Garrett he and Johns Hopkins each contributed $10,000 to building this first building. So another thing was that the Maryland Historical Society's first art exhibit, and I think it was about 1846 or 8, Johns Hopkins was among the exhibitors. Now, Johns Hopkins was very much interested in the art at Clifton, his country home. There were 100 statues there, and the description of Clifton at that time in a book by a landscape architect was that it was the most attractive place in the United States. The grounds are the most attractive. Johns Hopkins was very interested in architecture, and the house itself was regarded as one of the most attractive in the country. So you had a man who had so many interests, and Johns Hopkins was somebody who, although he had this wonderful home, he really in many ways was very frugal. That was why he was able to succeed, was he didn't spend his money until he'd earned it and became very well to do.
You've mentioned Clifton, which was his summer home. I was fascinated to learn that it had been his hope that that would become the location of the university. What do you know about that?
Well, that was his desire. But at the time when the trustees founded the university, they had a problem. One was they had a library down in Baltimore, the Peabody Library, which was founded by George Peabody, which was available to the university. They also had the library of the Maryland Historical Society. So they decided to locate the university near these two libraries, which was a practical thing to do. Now, actually, John W. Garrett was so upset by this that he resigned from the Board of Trustees, as did Lewis Hopkins, Johns Hopkins' nephew. But I think that although it would have been wonderful if the university and the medical school could have been located at Clifton, because it was such a beautiful location, as a practical matter, I think they did the wise thing. And it's a shame that over the years that when the city later acquired Clifton at a time when the B&O Railroad was having trouble and had given up paying a dividend. So the city of Baltimore bought Clifton for around $700,000 in the 1790s. But unfortunately, the place was never kept up the way it had been in Johns Hopkins' day. Another interesting thing is that Johns Hopkins' Aunt Margaret's grandson, Jesse Tyson, built Sylvan Mansion, which is now the city's center for gardening and horticulture and that sort of thing. So, but if you look at the park system in Baltimore City today, you have Hopkins Place, which is named after the home of Johns Hopkins' uncle, who Johns Hopkins worked for and went into business with. And you have Silburn, which was built by his cousin, Jesse Tyson, and you have Clifton Park, which was built by was Johns Hopkins' place. And then actually another place, the Carroll Mansion in Baltimore, Charles Carroll Carrollton's mother was related to John Hopkins' wife. They were members of the Brooke family. Also, Charles Carroll's not only his wife was related to them, but also his mother. So you had all these people had very close relationships, and they were an interesting group of people.
Now, you decided as a young man to take the idea of a Hopkins education very personally when you decided to go to the university. Tell me about your education.
Well, of course, I was very fortunate. I got what they call a trustee's grant, which paid the tuition at Hopkins. And so I went to Hopkins when I was 16 years old. And I somewhat, looking back on it, think I'd been better off if I'd gone when I was 18, because I was became more fully developed by the time I was senior. I was big enough to play on the football team. But I was probably the only person on the team that had never played on a high school football team, because I was so small when I first went to college. But at the time I went to Hopkins, it was a wonderful opportunity. It was smaller, and we had a very dedicated faculty. I majored in what they call business economics. And we had a wonderful student body. We had a wonderful faculty, and it's just amazed what these people have done who've made the university what it is, and all the people who participated in the contributions that the university has made to society in so many ways. And it's a story which I think hopefully should be told to young people, so hopefully it will inspire other people to follow in the steps of Johns Hopkins and George Peabody and Enoch Pratt and others who not only been successful in business, but who've left institutions which have contributed in really in expanding their contributions to the world.
You mentioned that there were outstanding faculty members there when you were there, and I did some homework, and it was quite a lineup of people who were on the faculty at the time you were a student. Tell me who was important to you. Who stands out in your memory?
Well, one of the people who stands out was when I was a freshman, I had ancient history was taught by Dr. Lane, who was a very distinguished man, a wonderful lecturer. The one course which I had the most trouble with was analytical geometry and calculus, which is taught by a graduate student, but my class was the last one that required analytical geometry and calculus. At that time, that was a course that a lot of people had trouble passing. But another person who taught at Hopkins as a freshman, his freshman class taught economic history, was Broadus Mitchell, who became quite a famous figure, among other things. He became a famous biographer of Alexander Hamilton. So another one was Dr. Cooper, who taught accounting, I remember with great affection. And another man who taught statistics was George Heberton Evans, who was a Hopkins graduate and whose course I enjoyed very especially.
And you're going too fast now. Slow down.
But one course that I really immensely enjoyed was taught by Dr. Secrets for geology. I think everybody ought to study geology because it sort of gives you basic understanding, appreciate of all the things that the earth is made up of. And every time I take a trip and I go somewhere, I think of the geology of the area.
Now, you've mentioned a lot.
Hey, yes. We're picking up some of the noise from the knee material, his hand.
Oh.
And it's obscuring his voice a little bit.
Okay.
I also just heard some power motor go off outside.
We can't control that. Okay. Can you just fix his mic? It hit the wire while we're interrupted. Bob is walking over and fix it real quick.
We need to fix something on your microphone.
It's this.
Rubbing his knee.
Yeah, unfortunately the mic is picking that up and it's obscuring his voice.
Sam, when you rub your knee,
okay,
the microphone is picking it up, believe
okay
it or not.
Well,
so
I'll stop rubbing my knee.
We'll try to control that, okay?
Okay.
You're doing a great job. Okay. Now, you have mentioned quite a few names that I am interested in because, of course, my real interest is the university itself. Tell me what you remember about Frederick Chapin Lane.
Well, Frederick Chapin Lane was a tall man. He was a thin man. He left Hopkins to go to Yale, but he made ancient history very attractive, and he was an authority on, I think, Venice. But that was a freshman. Another man taught English literature, who was very good, and I can't remember his name. I always remember his talking about Beowulf.
Oh.
And so but my freshman year, they were an interesting bunch of people. I also had to take French, and we had a Frenchman, I think his name was McKee, and he insisted on just speaking French perfectly, but he never could speak English perfectly, which always interested me. But I enjoyed French. That was sort of a nice thing to have.
And Broadus Mitchell. Now, that's quite a name associated with Johns Hopkins. Right. Tell me more about him.
Well, Broadus Mitchell was always lambasting the trustees. And finally, when Dr. Bowman was the president of the university, Broadus offered to resign, and Dr. Mitchell's resignation was accepted by Dr. Bowman. And it was after that, Broadus, I went and taught in Puerto Rico. But some years later, when Hopkins used to have, on February the 2nd, they'd have a dinner at the Belvedere Hotel. And I was then on the board of the Alumni Association, and we wanted to get a speaker. So I was asked to contact Broadus Mitchell, which I did. And Broadus was so excited to come back to Hopkins that he was willing to pay his own airfare from Puerto Rico to come to the dinner. But then we had the dinner, and the man who introduced Broadus went into all the difficulties and arguments Broadus had at the university at the time when Broadus wanted to come back and have a very peaceful, wonderful evening. But Broadus was the best entertainer I've ever known, and nobody ever went to sleep in Broadus Mitchell's class.
Why?
Well, Broadus, among other things, became a socialist candidate for governor in Maryland. And he was a great entertainer. He was originally from Mississippi. So he's one that I remember very, very vividly. And his economic history was very well done. I think everybody ought to take a course in economic history.
And you mentioned Heb Evans.
Well, George Heberton Evans was a graduate of Hopkins and taught statistics, and he was a nice person as an individual and very interested in students.
Did you cross paths with any of the people who became famous for the History of Ideas Club? Like Arthur Lovejoy or George Boas?
Well, I knew George Boas. I didn't know Arthur Lovejoy. I just knew him by name. But George Boas was very controversial in many ways.
Why?
Well, I don't remember all the details, but he was allegedly had ideas that were different from some other people's. But I think he taught philosophy. But I never was in his class.
How about William Foxwell Albright?
Well, I knew him, but I never was in his class because he was very much interested in things dealing with the Bible. But I remember meeting Dr. Albright once when he came across the street to visit my mother-in-law, Mrs. Joseph Colt Bloodgood, whose husband had been a surgeon at the Johns Hopkins Medical School and was really the originator of the idea of wearing rubber gloves, which cut down on infections.
Did you get to know John French?
I knew him, but not very well. He wrote a history of the university. I remember him very well, but I can't say that I was close to him.
His history is a Bible for me. So
that's right.
I feel very personal. I was hoping you maybe had known him well.
Well, he was a nice person. Everybody liked him.
And he had been around for a very long time, hadn't
right.
he?
What's that?
Hadn't he been around for
yes,
a very
he had,
long
for
time?
A very long time, that's right. He was very well thought of. Well, the university had so many people who were well thought of. You know, if you read the paper today, there's never an edition of the Sun papers that doesn't have something about Johns Hopkins in it. But I think another thing, I remember when I was going to the University of Maryland Law School at that time, they had a contest to pick Baltimore's outstanding citizen, and they picked Johns Hopkins. Then about 2 years ago, a magazine or somebody picked Johns Hopkins again to be Baltimore's outstanding citizen. But when you think today, Baltimore, Maryland's largest employer are the Johns Hopkins Institutions, the medical school, and the hospital, which together employ something over 40,000 people. And it's an institution which touches the whole world, and particularly in the area of health. And you have the Rockefellers coming to Hopkins and picking it for their interest in starting a school of public health, which trains people who've contributed to public health all over the world. It's just amazing what Johns Hopkins, the great thing that Johns Hopkins did was that he provided institutions where other people could accomplish things, and institutions which other people could participate, not only as professors, as pioneers in science and everything under the sun, but also institutions where people who were philanthropic inclined could contribute their wealth to carrying on these institutions. And to me, that was Johns Hopkins' great contribution, was picking the right people to run the place, and then picking people who would interest other people, both individuals and donors, who'd carry on this tradition. And I sometimes think that I've been very much interested in somebody writing the story of Johns Hopkins, which brings out the environment in which the man lived, his family, their background, the contribution that Lord Baltimore made when he adopted a policy of religious toleration in this colony, which attracted these people who it gave them opportunities to express themselves and to use their talents, as did Johns Hopkins and his family. And also the same contributions was made by William Penn in providing an opportunity for people to come and live in an atmosphere of religious freedom and opportunity to make contributions to society. So to me, this whole story is an amazing thing, and it's you can't put enough significance on what Lord Baltimore did when he established a policy of religious toleration. It, I think, has contributed a great deal to the success of America in attracting people who would make outstanding contributions to the betterment of the world.
Well, Johns Hopkins was certainly part of that story. Now, when you were there as a student, you were there really at the height of the Depression. How much was that a factor in campus life? Did you live on campus?
No, I didn't actually. One year when I was at Hopkins, I got free room and board with a family named Buck, who was one of the nicest people in the world. And I had the job of taking care of the furnace. Another year, I got free room and board from the family of a cousin named Mrs. Richard White, whose husband had died, and she wanted a man in the house. And then another year, I got free room and board living with my cousin, Helen Hopkins, Tom, who wrote A Life of Johns Hopkins, who lived on Utah Place. So my education was provided by a contribution of getting a free tuition at Johns Hopkins and a place to live by these people, which worked out very well. And I was always very interested in athletics, but having gone to college when I was 16 and not being only weighing about 135 pounds by the time I was a senior, I was on the football team. But I'd been much better if I'd gone to college when I was 18, so I'm not very much in favor of going there before you're more physically developed.
Were athletics important on campus then?
Well, yes, they were, but it was a much smaller institution then, and most of the athletes were very close together. And we had a wonderful football coach named Ray Van Orman, who'd been an All-American football player at Cornell University.
I'm curious about whether football or lacrosse was the dominant sport then.
Well, lacrosse, I'd say, has always been the dominant sport at Hopkins. But then the student body was very small. I think we started out with about 300 people in the freshman class, and we ended up with 125. But the attrition rate was very high.
Was the Depression a factor in that?
Well, I think it was, yes. We were very much very conscious of the Depression. Those were odd times.
Tell me more.
Well, I sort of think, always remember this, the man at the corner of Calvert and Fed Streets who sold apples. And that was sort of an example of Depression, but it was very hard on a lot of people.
And how did it take form on campus?
Well, I don't think we were too as conscious of it. Most people seem to make out all right. But obviously, some people didn't go to college because of it. But you know, going to college was so much less expensive than tuition was $400 a year. It's almost unbelievable how times have changed. And I don't know what the answer to it is, but I think that we've got to do everything we can to make education more affordable to more people. But it's amazing the sacrifices that people met to send their children to college in view of the high cost. But times have changed, but of course faculty salaries were minuscule then compared to what they are now.
The campus was itself was much simpler back then, but one of the things I noticed is that when you were there, the new student union Levering Hall was brand new.
That's right.
Was that an important place on campus?
That was very, very important. That was a wonderful institution, and you had a cafeteria there, and it was the center of things for the university. And a lot of the kids could play, I remember, played cards there in the vestibule. But one of the things was Johns Hopkins YMCA was founded there in the late 1800s, and I think it has always been a big factor in the Johns Hopkins University.
I also picked up that back then, people referred to Johns Hopkins University as the Hopkins.
That's right.
Tell me about that, and tell me about how the university fits into life in Baltimore.
Well, I think that the first president of the university, Dr. Gilman, was very much interested in the affairs of the city. And the faculty in those days played a very, very big role in all civic activities. And you had, I think that I think is not, they have not played as big a role today as they did, say, in the late 1800s, where Dr. Gilman was a very, very big factor. And he must have been an amazing man, but when I was at Hopkins, his daughter was still alive, Elizabeth Gilman, who was very active in the Socialist Party and very socially minded, and she lived in a house on Park Avenue, just next to where the Maryland Historical Society is, so she was quite a figure. But I remember her calling me up once and wanting to know something about a stock. But she was a very positive person. And she used to have students who would stay at our house who went to Hopkins. One of them was a friend of mine named McNair, and another was a boy named Yardley. But they called her Lizzie Gilman. She was, I think she may have run for governor, ran for some office on a socialist ticket in Baltimore. She was very close to Broadus Mitchell.
That is fascinating.
So she was quite a figure. But Broadus was always lambasting the trustees.
Why?
Well, for various things, he thought they were doing that the right way. And as I mentioned earlier, he ultimately, Dr. Bowman, accepted his resignation. Well, one person who I was very fond of and I had an association with was Dr. Bowman, who was a very nice person.
Tell me about him.
Well, he was a geographer, and he came to Hopkins in, I know it was there at the time of World War II, because I went over to Washington one day when I was going into the Navy, and I happened to see Dr. Bowman at the Union Station, and he came over to me and he said, "Will you sit with me?" There was somebody he saw in the station who was going to Washington he didn't want to sit with, so he asked me if I would sit with him. So that was one of my associations with Dr. Bowman.
What was he like?
Well, he was a very nice man. He had a daughter, Olive Bowman, who I was very fond of.
What kind of impact did he have on the university?
Well, I think it was a very good one. They had some very fortunate in having some good people. When I was there, Dr. Joseph Ames was the president of the university. And actually, some of his family have restored a room at Clifton. And the Thompson family, his wife's family were named Thompson, and the original owner of Clifton was Mr. Thompson, and some of his descendants have restored a room over there very beautifully, and they're very interested in Clifton and its restoration. But this man who's particularly interested was Joseph Ames Thompson, who's named after Dr. Thompson. Dr. Ames was the president of the university in my day, and he was a very nice person. I remember being taken to see him when I was in high school to meet him and talk about going to the university. He had an office in what was then Remsen Hall, and I assume still is.
How about fraternities? Were they important on campus?
Yes, fraternities were important. I suppose maybe half the student body belonged to fraternities. But I think that they played quite a part in kids' lives, and I think mostly on the good side. It gave a chance for kids to get to know each other better. But I don't think Hopkins could ever be considered as a big fraternity college.
So what role did they play?
Well, they were really small clubs that students could belong to. And most of them would have a meeting. And one thing, the one I belonged to, you used to have to give a talk at every meeting. So people had the experience of talking about something. And I think they gave people the experience of running some institution. They were little institutions. They had the experience of running a fraternity house, and most of them served meals. They'd have a house, and a lot of the students would go there to lunch. So I think they played an important role in a lot of people's lives.
Did people live in the fraternity houses?
Yes. They'd house a few people. But then, of course, they didn't have nearly as much on-campus living facilities as they have now. So a lot of the students would rent rooms and houses in the neighborhood. And no people could live in a fraternity house and have their meals there. But I think that a lot of the kids who didn't live in the fraternity house would go there to lunch. But at that time, a very high percentage of Hopkins students came from Baltimore, and they lived at home. And that was one of the effects of the Depression. It made possible to go. I mean, tuition was only $400 a year, so you could live at home and get a college education for a relatively small amount of money compared to today. But I would say I don't know. I'd always say well over 50% of the Hopkins students have lived in Baltimore and lived at home. So that was one of the things that the depression did. And things were so much smaller then. Hopkins was only had a few hundred students. I mean, the University of Maryland, I think, at College Park then had about 1,500 students. So it's hard to realize how things have grown, and so much a larger percentage of the population goes to college now, particularly women. And of course, in those days, Goucher College was thriving and was very close to Hopkins.
So tell me about the social life at Hopkins.
Well, I'd say that Hopkins was not big on social life. A lot of it centered around the fraternities. And they'd have a June week, that would be a big thing at graduation time.
Tell me about June week.
Well, they generally have a dance and other things. They'd have three or four events.
And did that go on, were classes continuing during
that
period?
Well, it was after classes were about over, I think, by the time of June week. But things were so much smaller then. It's hard to realize how the times have changed on that score.
Were there a lot of organizations on campus?
Oh, yes. You had all kinds of organizations. You had a glee club, which was very successful. You had a student newspaper, which was very successful. And you had all kinds of groups. At Hopkins, they had plenty of groups, and a lot of people were interested in the YMCA. But I've got to stop for a minute.
All right, let's take a break.
I am now rolling.
And actually, before you start, what's our time so Maine has an idea?
We're only 48 minutes in.
Okay, great.
You mentioned McCoy Hall. Tell me why.
Well, you know, later on I found in life more about John McCoy. He was a remarkable man, and he was really, I think, the first major contributor to the Johns Hopkins University after Johns Hopkins. And I remember we had McCoy Hall. Now, this brings my thought really to, I never knew anything. Nobody told me who Mr. McCoy was when I was at Hopkins, and looking back on it, I think it'd been nice if they students had been given an address in which he talked about a little of the history of the university and the background, the things we've talked about today, and the Johns Hopkins, the things that guided his life, and this sort of thing. And same thing would be true of Mr. McCoy. Mr. McCoy was very interested in the well-being of the poor and other people in Baltimore City, and must have been a remarkable man. I think he gave his library to the university when he died, and he also gave him some money. So that's, when I was a freshman, the freshmen all had to go to, I think once a month they'd have a lecture you had to go to, and I think looking back on it, it would have been very good if one or more of those lectures had been dealt with the history of the background of the university and Johns Hopkins' personality and the personnel and something more about the individuals that contributed to the success of the university. And I don't know whether it seems to be, if this isn't done, this might be a good thing about doing now.
Well, you know, you're very timely, because just this year there is a movement on campus talking about Hopkins traditions. And I've just been contacted by those people. And so I was so excited that I was coming to interview you, because I thought you could perhaps share with me some of the things that you would consider to be Hopkins traditions at the university.
Well, I think that if I were a student there now, I'd like to know about some of the people and the things that got at their lives and something about their lives. You know, I think people today need role models and something that they can hang on to. And I think there's so many good role models at Hopkins that would be very helpful. One thing I belonged to at Hopkins was the Tudor and Stewart Club.
You did? Tell me about that.
Well, they had a room and we could go there. A lot of people got the equivalent of a free lunch there. And but that was a small group of literary society. And Dr. Osler had a son who was killed in World War I, and he left a small amount of money, which I think endowed that little society. And I still get an invitation every now and then to something. But I haven't been to anything there for years. The last time I went to something, the room was so crowded and so hot that I practically fainted. But it was a nice little group. But that was one of the places where I came very close to some of the faculty other than those who taught economics and business. So,
and who was in the Tudor and Stewart Club?
Well, I can't remember any name, but it was mostly people who were interested in English literature.
One of the things, when I looked at your yearbook, I noticed that Philip Hamburger was one of your classmates. Did you know him well?
Not very well, no. Well, there's a Dr. Hamburger there, when he was very active in the faculty for years.
Did you know him?
Yes, very well.
Was that Ferdinand Hamburger?
Ferdinand Hamburger. He was very active at the time. They had a celebration, must have been the 100th anniversary of the university, and he worked with me on having a family party. Then he retired and lived over at the church home, and I remember going over there to having lunch one day with a friend, and he was there for lunch. But I remember at the same time, that was regarded as the most attractive retirement home in the state of Maryland.
Church home?
Yeah, there's a little place in the church home where retired people lived. And a man who told me that, somebody had been an inspector for the state for the church for institutions, and when he retired, he said that's where he went because that was the best.
I'm curious about, very much about what life was like on campus in the 30s, and I wondered, given what was happening in the rest of the world, and also what I know some things about Dr. Bowman, was there a sense of anti-Semitism on campus? I understand that there was a quota system of how many Jewish students were allowed. Is that something you were aware of?
I don't know about it. I wasn't aware of it. Actually, the Jewish percentage of Jewish students has always been very high at Hopkins, and certainly was very high in my time. I'd say it was, they were very well represented. Now, most of the fraternities were, several Jewish fraternities, actually the mayor of New York was supposed to be one of the first Jewish people who was admitted to a non-Jewish fraternity at Hopkins. Seems to me I read about that somewhere, so I don't know what the situation is now. But at that time, the Jewish students had their own fraternities. But the percentage of Jewish students was very high. No, I never heard anything about a quota, if there was one.
And I also saw that there was an active honor system.
That's right.
At Johns Hopkins then. Tell me about that. What role did the honor system play?
Well, it was run by the students, really. So I think it was very good.
But there doesn't seem to be anything like that now.
I don't know.
Do you remember how you were made aware of the honor system?
Well, there was a board that was elected, picked by the students that ran the honor system, as I remember.
And I'll tell you one thing that I found very interesting about you. I couldn't find your picture in the yearbook on athletic teams. Why is that?
Well, I was so hot up, I didn't have the money to get my picture taken, I think.
Is that the reason?
Well, it's the only reason I can think of.
Well, I'm also curious about the degree you got in business economics.
That's right.
Was that in the School of Arts and Sciences?
Well, yes, but they abolished it later. There were a lot of people on the faculty that didn't like the idea of having such a practical course. That was one problem. I mean, the faculty was dominated by people who were very much for the academic side.
But McCoy College was certainly offering
business. Oh, yes, very
classes.
Much so. Well, there were always people who were opposed to McCoy College.
Tell me why.
Well, I don't know. A lot of people felt that you should have full-time faculty. See, when I went to the University of Maryland Law School, most of the faculty were part-time. But now it's almost entirely full-time. So then, when I went to the University of Maryland Law School, I think the tuition was something like $300 a year. Now it's $5,000 or $6,000. And one of the reasons for the big change is that you have a much more expensive faculty because they don't use part-time people. But people regard it as sort of an honor to teach at the University of Maryland Law School for a very low salary. But times have changed. And
did you know, even when you were an undergraduate, that you wanted to be an attorney?
Well, I guess I probably did, yes.
What was your plan with, how were you planning to use your business in economics?
Well, I went to work for the Fidelity Deposit Company where I used it because I ran the investment side of the business. And I more or less stayed with that. Then later on, I went with Alex Brown. But I was very much interested in economics, really, I guess. In fact, I've written a little bit on the subject. That was has been my major interest. But of course, as you can see from that material you got, I've had a lot of interest.
You certainly have, and you've certainly been very involved in civic things here in Baltimore and in Maryland. Shall we talk some about that?
Well, I've been very fortunate. No, when I went to this one-room school...
Hold on a moment. We have an interruption.
Hold on. We're going to stop the camera for a second.
That's all right.
Well, I'll tell you, I've been very fortunate in life. I've always had people who took an interest in me when I went to this...
Hold on just a moment.
Okay, we're ready.
We have to wait for them to let us know.
Go ahead.
Okay. I've always been very fortunate in life, and I've had other people take an interest in me when I went to this little one-room school. The teacher there took a great interest in me, and as a result of that, I did 7 years and 5 years. Then I went to four-room high school in Clarksville, Maryland. The first year, we had a wonderful faculty. The next year, three of the faculty had gone. We had new people, and the Roughnecks just took over, and I had the experience of seeing the school deteriorate immensely. Then the next year, I went to McDonough, where the head of the school, Lewis Lambin, took a great personal interest in me. And then when I went to college, I had the same thing. And then after I got out of college, I had people like Robert G. Merrick took an interest in me and Jacob France. They sort of became mentors as far as I was concerned. And I've had a host of other people. So I think that I've been very fortunate.
You mentioned Mr. Merrick. Let's talk about him a little bit, because he's a very important name in the Hopkins story.
Well, he was one of the hardest working, most dedicated people I've ever known. He never wasted anybody else's time, and as did Jake France. Jake France told me once that the most important thing in life is don't waste other people's time. But they had two people who played a big role in my life, and as a result of their interest in me, I got into some of the things I got into because they were the ones suggested me.
Tell me more. Tell me more. What did they get you interested in?
Well, start out with Mr. Merrick got me on the board of his bank, and Mr. France got me in. He was interested in politics, and so it was it all just fitted in. I mean, Mr. Merrick got me on the board of the Baltimore Museum of Art and the board of the Peale Museum. And so it was all, I'm a great believer in having mentors if you can find them, and I'm a great believer in it. Actually, I found in my last years in business, my really main contribution was helping younger people take an interest in them. And I think this is another thing that Johns Hopkins, during his lifetime, he was very good at taking an interest in younger people who were successful in business and picking out people who would be successful in business. And I remember there was a man in Baltimore named Summerfield Baldwin who was very successful in the cotton manufacturing business. And his family were benefited by Johns Hopkins picking them out to run a cotton factory in Savage, Maryland. So that was one of his talents, was picking out young people who would be successful and supporting them and other people. And Johns Hopkins in his day was what you'd call an entrepreneur today. And this is another fact about Johns Hopkins that should be brought out in, if anybody ever writes this, a really good biography of Johns Hopkins, was his interest in younger people and in helping people succeed. And Johns Hopkins and Enoch Pratt and George Peabody, as you know, during the Civil War supported the Union, and for many people they were unpopular because of this. They had positions which were different. And in fact, the whole background of Johns Hopkins is based on people who made a difference starting out, as I mentioned before. Lord Baltimore starting a colony is different. William Penn starting a colony is different. And then George Fox coming along with the Society of Friends and the idea of human equality and treating everybody with respect regardless of their rank or success, and then a sense of helping other people in life. And it's more of a one-on-one, so they really were pioneers. And of course, a lot of people didn't like this, so they weren't necessarily the most popular people in the world. Johns Hopkins was not popular with a lot of people in his day. That's another thing you have to take into account. But you can look at that. Well, I mentioned that Benjamin Lundy coming to Baltimore and starting this anti-slavery magazine, which was the first in the United States in which Johns Hopkins' uncle advertised. And you had to be different in Maryland to advertise an anti-slavery magazine, which was first published in 1824. So they were different, but they also were pioneers. And this is another part of the Hopkins story, which I think should be told in trying to figure out the kind of person Johns Hopkins was and the things that moved him to make the contributions he did.
I'm fascinated by your suggestion that someone should write a more in-depth biography of Johns Hopkins himself. Do you think that there are untapped sources of documentary evidence that haven't been looked at?
Well, I think that the thing that's never been looked at or written about is the environment that Johns Hopkins lived in, and this fact, the contributions of people who made a difference, and it ties in with Maryland history, it ties in with Pennsylvania history, and it ties in with the history of America, because these people created an environment where people had greater opportunity to succeed in life and to accomplish something. It made a big difference having a colony where you had religious toleration and one where you had religious freedom from a society where, as it was in Virginia, where the Puritans were kicked out and the Quakers were kicked out. And at the same time, Elizabeth Harris was coming to Maryland and was very well received in Maryland. Quakers were actually executed in Massachusetts. In fact, this lady up here is great-great-grandfather left Massachusetts and went to New Jersey because they were Quakers.
You mentioned the centennial of the university in 1976. How did you participate in that celebration?
Well, they wanted to get the Hopkins faculty interested, so I financed a lunch they had, for one thing, at the Lord Baltimore Hotel, to which they invited members of the Johns Hopkins collateral descendants. That's children, descendants of his brothers and sisters, come to lunch. And at that time, I worked very closely with Ferdinand Hamburger. But another thing which I haven't mentioned was in the 1950s, a man came to see me named Connolly, who worked for the Los Angeles Times, who was writing a history of Johns Hopkins. And he told me that one of the things he'd found was evidence that during the Civil War, Johns Hopkins had bribed members of the Maryland legislature to keep Maryland in the Union. And but I wondered whatever happened to the material this man had, because he had been retained by a publisher who was located then in Westminster, Maryland, to write the life of Johns Hopkins. But then he died, and I don't know what, somebody must have all the material that he collected, but he'd run down and interviewed descendants of Johns Hopkins family slaves who'd been freed. And he was just fascinated by Johns Hopkins' story. So that's another thing that somebody ought to run down, find out what happened to that material. But his name was Connolly, and I've got copies of several letters that he wrote me.
Did you want to repeat any of that, May? Because we did hear that on the tape.
No, I am interested in what he's saying, but it's okay. I don't think we would need that. So have we stopped now?
No, we're still rolling.
I just wanted to let you know.
No, that's fine. But that's very interesting.
But that's another thing should be run down.
Well, you're giving me all kinds of ideas. Tell me about this brunch that you had. Who came? And how many people did you get there, and how did you get them?
I don't know, there were about 70. Well, at that time, the university sponsored the idea of making a list of all Johns Hopkins collateral descendants, which we did, and which you all have a copy of. Then we updated that list a couple of years ago. But no, I worked on that list of getting the names and addresses of all these people, and there were quite a number of them.
I would love to see that list.
Yeah.
That would be fascinating. So why do you think it was important for the Hopkins family to be involved in the centennial celebration?
Well, the university was very much interested in being involved. One of the things they had was somebody in the family, the Shah of Persia, came and spoke, and they had demonstrators. It was the Lyric Theater. So a fair number of them came. But more recently, we had this gift of a professorship, Hopkins family professorship at the medical school for a professor of oncology. And this was last May. And we also had a party the university had at the Peabody. Then we had a reception at Clifton. This was another family thing. And that was last May. So there must have been 100 people there. But one of the things they've been running down now, descendants of Johns Hopkins, Aunt Margaret Hopkins, who married Jesse Tyson, and a good many of them were there. Of course, the university is interested in all these people, and hopefully they'll take an interest in the university.
And is that happening?
Well, it happened. They founded this fellowship. But my children endowed a scholarship at the University of Maryland Law School, and my wife and my name last year.
Uh-huh.
So things are still happening in the family.
Well, we're all beneficiaries of that.
But my thought is that I think it would be very interesting to the students of the university if somebody could put this story together so they would know something about Johns Hopkins and the things that guided his life. And they're all the things that are conducive to a successful life.
Tell me about your interest in restoring Clifton House.
Well, as I told you, in The 1976 Schaefer was very interested, and he spent a lot of money fixing up Clifton. And then the thing sort of went to pot for a while, and then in 1985, the place was empty, and the city leased the building to Civic Works for $1 a year, and it's their headquarters, and since then, they've been trying to get it restored. But in 1985, when I retired as a member, since 1995 as a member of the Baltimore City Planning Commission, Chapin had a meeting at Clifton. They invited me to come and gave me a recognition of some kind. And so at that time, I got on the board of Civic Works, and they had gotten a grant of $200,000 from the state towards restoring the building. And then in, I think it was about 2000, I gave them some money, and they put up an exhibit over there, which you'd enjoy seeing, about philanthropy in Baltimore and the idea that Baltimore is the cradle of American philanthropy. And that exhibit's still in being, but the latest thing at Clifton is that it's just about finished as a contract to restore the roof for $374,000, which is in bad shape. And they've got a couple $100,000 more, which can be used, and I've given them something over $200,000. And in 2000, I think it was 2002, they had this birthday party for me, which raised some money to restore Clifton. So things are moving slowly, but ultimately we hope some useful purpose can be made of Clifton. But one of the group has taken interest and did a wonderful job of restoring a room for the family of the Thompson family, and President Joseph Ames of the Johns Hopkins University's wife was named Thompson, and she was a Thompson descendant. And a boy, whose name Joseph Ames Thompson, named after the president, was one of the principal sponsors and contributors towards restoring this roof at Clifton because of his ancestor. So that's another connection. Dr. Ames was a delightful person. He was a very quiet-spoken, very nice man.
Back when you were a student, was there an interaction between the university president and the students? It sounds like you got to know him. Was it because you were an unusual student, or did everybody get to know him?
I got to know him because my name was Hopkins, and I was taken to see him when I was in high school. But the person we were closest to was the dean of students.
Tell me about him.
Well, I can't even remember his name, but he was a very nice man.
Is that Dr. Barry?
Dr. Barry, that's right. I remember him very well.
What? Tell me about him.
Well, he was very interested in students. He was a nice man. But I never knew him terribly personally, but so I knew more of his presence.
Was there anyone on campus who was a particular mentor to you?
Well, I'd say of all the faculty that I was personally closest to, one was Dr. Wafers. But this came more after I left school. Another while I was there and afterwards was Dr. Cooper, who taught accounting.
What was the first name you mentioned?
Dr. Wafers. He taught economics. And Dr. Cooper taught accounting. One man I was very close to who taught French was named Hasbrook. He was a very nice person, Hasbrook. And he had been a newspaper reporter who'd come to see Dr. Ames one day about something, and Dr. Ames offered him a job teaching, so he came to Hopkins to teach French. But he was of French Huguenot descent from New York. But he was a special man. He was very popular with students. He was a very, very interesting man. I can't even remember his first name, but he stood out as far as I was concerned. But when I was a freshman, ancient history class talking about it. Dr. Lane was lecturing, and once a week you'd have a smaller group and sit down with a graduate student, and the man who did that was very good, but I can't remember his name. But I was always very interested in history, and I think if I'd gone on to graduate school, I'd have gotten a degree in history.
You mentioned that many people lived in homes around the campus.
Right.
Had the dormitories opened at that point?
Oh, yes, the dormitories built in about 1918.
Right, there were dormitories.
Oh, yes, there were, but they couldn't take care of more than a small part of the students. There was just that one dormitory, which is still there.
So did you spend any time in the dorms?
Well, the only time I ever went to the dorms was the football team when I was a junior. We used to have dinner there. We got a free dinner every night. And the next year we had our dinners in a restaurant, but I never had any connection with the dorm, particularly other than knowing some of the students were there. And I suppose I visited several times students in their rooms. But I never spent a night in the dormitory. But a lot of the kids had lived in boarding houses or had rooms somewhere, and some lived in fraternity houses. But most of them lived at home.
Another long time establishment on campus that I think has been important to you is the Hopkins Club.
Oh, yes, very much so.
Tell me about your association with that.
Well, the Hopkins Club, the architect was the son of my first wife's godmother, Jenks, Francis Jenks. And I became a member when it was founded in 1938. Before that, at one time, the Hopkins Club had been in the Carroll Mansion. And Bob Merrick, when he was at Hopkins, I think lived in the Carroll Mansion taking care of the Hopkins Club there. It also was home of the Gilman School at one time. But that was one of the reasons Bob Merrick was so interested in the restoration of the Carroll Mansion. And that was one of his projects. But he was very interested in that.
You're speaking of Homewood House.
That's right. But you know, you mentioned George Boas. Jake French resigned as a trustee of the Hopkins because his concern about George Boas. I think that's one of the things that moved him to resign.
Tell me what you mean.
I don't remember much, but I just have in the back of my mind that when Jake France resigned from the Board of Trustees of Hopkins, it was because he felt they shouldn't keep George Boas on the faculty. Or somebody. Whether it was George Boas or somebody else, but I think it may have been George Boas. George Boas was regarded as being somewhat on to the left.
We had some interesting and controversial people back then.
Oh, yes, we had very much so.
How about the School of Engineering? How did it fit in?
Well, the School of Engineering was abolished. But when I was in the legislature, they had a bill in the legislature, and part of it was to restore the School of Engineering. But the person who was very interested in that, who had been the majority leader of the House of Delegates, was Kent Mulliken, who was a very good friend of mine, you know, Hopkins graduate. He was a very loyal alumnus, Kent R. Mulliken.
I knew him well.
Do you knew him?
Very well. Very well.
Well, he was a nice person. He was very interested in Annapolis. Of course, he owned that hotel down that one time. So it's a small world.
It's a very small world. I knew Kent Mulliken since I was a little
but
child.
He was the main sponsor of getting this bill passed at the Hopkins. I think it had something to do with the engineering school. But the engineering school was still going in my day, but then they let it drop. Now it's come back very strong.
When you were in the House of Delegates, did business related to the university or the hospital come up very often?
Well, the only time I remember it coming up was when Ken Mulliken came down there lobbying for whatever it was. I think it was engineering school. No, I don't think it did. It probably did, but I wasn't particularly conscious of it.
And how about the hospital? Have you been involved at all with the hospital?
Well, my first involvement was the hospital. I had my tonsils taken out in about 1928. I remember that. But I remember going over there, but I've never had any personal involvement. My involvement in hospitals was the Shepherd Pratt Hospital, which was founded by my first cousin, many times removed, was a Shepherd. I was on that board for 17 years.
So what we refer to as the East Baltimore campus is not a place that you've spent much time?
No. Well, I was very interested because my first wife's father was a member of the faculty there and was a surgeon, and as I mentioned, was a person who introduced the idea of rubber gloves. But he was devoted to the institution.
There were some very big names there in East Baltimore, too, and I just wondered if you'd ever had any interactions with any of those people.
Well, I knew Dr. Blaylock very well.
You did? Tell me about him, and how did you know him?
Dr. Blaylock lived down the street from us. We lived on Wendover Road at that time, and Dr. Blaylock had the first television in the neighborhood. My children used to go over there to look at Howdy Doody. And so our family had a very close relationship with Dr. Blaylock, among other people. But Dr. Welsh was my first wife's godfather.
Well, tell me about that. Did you get to know Dr. Welsh?
No, I never did, but I just knew that he was our godfather. But he was apparently a very remarkable man. But he was one of those people that sort of made Hopkins. He was an example of an individual who thrived on the opportunity which Johns Hopkins provided him in founding the institution. And he was the one that got the Rockefeller Foundation interested in the public health school. So, I've known some of the others, but I can't really remember their names too well. But it's had an immense number of really very significant people.
You know, I could sit here and listen to your stories all day, but I don't want to wear you out completely. What haven't we talked about that we should?
Well, I think you've talked about everything, but when everything's said and done, I think that it would be a service to humanity if somebody would tell the story of Johns Hopkins and the things that guided his life and the idea of helping other people to cope better with life and to contribute to society. Because I think, you know, when I was growing up, kids read books about kids who were successful and sort of good role models, but you don't have that anymore. People are very cynical about it. They refuse to recognize any goodness. And what the world's problems are only going to be solved by individuals who do things on an individual basis, take an interest in other people. And there are a lot of people in a position to do it who aren't doing it. But George Peabody told Johns Hopkins that he enjoyed making money, but he found he enjoyed using it usefully more than he did making it. And I think that's the story of Johns Hopkins, a man who enjoyed making money, worked hard, and he was very loyal to his family. His mother, who lived with him, and sister who's a widow, and then to his nieces and nephews. And then beyond that, he made other contributions to society, and he really provided an opportunity for other people to make a contribution to society. And I think the world needs more people like that.
Indeed. It has been a true pleasure to sit here with you and capture some of your memories. Thank you so much.
But you know over there, that's Ellicott's Mills.
I was looking at that.
In 1854.
I was looking at that while we were setting up.
And down the lower right-hand corner is a little picture of my great-great-grandfather's house, George Ellicott, whose wife was a cousin, first cousin, of Jared Hopkins' wife. So it's a small world. And that's my grandmother up there, and there is Martha Ellicott Tyson, who was the principal founder of Swarthmore College. And that's her husband, Nathan Tyson, who's the son of Elisha Tyson, and the first president of the Baltimore Chamber of Commerce, which is a grain exchange.
It's quite a heritage you have.
So it's an interesting world.
Sam, thank you.
Well, thank you.
I'll let you rest now.
Give my best to your dad.
I will indeed.